A little bit of Michael Jackson in the background vocals there. It's Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I'm Stu Nicholson, sitting in for Ann for the next couple of days. Should internet search engines like Yahoo or Google or popular sites like Facebook be able to track not only your every move, but the interests you express online and even the people you're connected to, and then sell that information to data brokers who then sell your information to advertisers? Internet tracking is what it's called, and there are ways to limit it, but only up to a point. Should it even be allowed? Should there be a do not track list, much as was directed at telephone telemarketers with the do not call list? This is one of the questions we're going to be taking up on All Sides this morning. And if you have a question or a comment, we'd like you to call in at 614-292-8513. What are your concerns about technology and how it's impacted our private lives and perhaps too much? So give us a call at All Sides, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And joining us now to talk about this question is Steve Fox, the editorial director and vice president of PC World Magazine in the heart of the computer country in the San Francisco area. Welcome, Steve.
Good to be here, Stu.
It's good to have you on the show. Let's talk a little bit, just kind of set it up a little bit. What exactly is internet tracking, and how is it used often without our knowledge?
Sure. Well, this is probably the hottest topic right now in privacy, you know, within technology. The whole issue that you can go to a site and it uses little bits of code to track you, to know what you're doing, to record that information. You know, you have, if you like something, if you viewed something. And the ideal reason why sites would do this, what they claim, and it is legitimate as far as that goes, is they can take these sort of preferences that you're expressing through where you visit and everything else, and they can create these a profile of you that allows them to target ads to you, ads that might be more appropriate, something you might want to see. Keep in mind that sites make their money, many of them, by selling ads. And they can do a lot better if those ads are effective and you're going to click on them. So a targeted ad, as far as a site is concerned, is a much more effective tool than you would get just sending out any old ad with banners. But it does bring up, there are certain implications here. And the whole idea that you can be tracked, that everything you're doing, even though you feel like it's relatively anonymous, you go to a website, you click on some things, you read some articles, you know, it's hard to imagine at that point that someone is creating essentially a profile of you. And it gets even more insidious when you think about the idea that a lot of that information that is collected on you and your behavior is then being sold to these brokers, large online brokers, that aggregate all this information and, you know, ultimately follow you around on the internet so that when they see that, you know, user X is visiting a different site, but when at his previous site he was clicking on, you know, information about, I don't know, could be some medical needs, you'll suddenly get an ad about those specific needs. When I was doing a little research for this yesterday, I was clicking around, you know, looking up different do not track legislation material, and on one site an ad popped up advertising a phone that was something I had been researching, because I'm thinking of buying it, the previous week. So obviously, you know, somewhere in there it said, ah, here's Steve Fox. He's been thinking about buying a, you know, Droid, you know, Razer Max, and here's an ad for it. Now, maybe it was coincidence, but I think not.
All of this strikes me, you know, I think the old term would be Orwellian. The more modern term, if I might borrow one from one of my daughters, is it's a little creepy, Dad.
Yeah. Well, it's even a lot creepy. But what you have to consider here is everyone is trying to figure out how to balance this idea of privacy versus, you know, internet innovation or commerce versus personal protection. Remember, we go online, and we're not paying anything for this, you know, by and large. We're paying for the service itself, but you go to a lot of websites. They're providing content. It costs, you know, a decent amount of money to run these sites, and they need to figure out a way to have a business model that works. So absolutely it's creepy, but it's also one of the things that keeps all of this information out there online. But of course, when you get something like this, where this many people are uncomfortable with what's going on, and you've got data brokers, standard that you'll see the government step in, or at least, you know, start to make some harumphing noises about what's happening. And right now there are some bills in Congress that are looking at Do Not Track as a concept, as something that they would try to implement. And those laws, the specific laws right now, from my understanding, is are pretty much stalled, but the industry itself is looking at ways of self-regulating, because they would much rather do some self-regulating, whether it's effective or not, we'll see, but, you know, and keep Congress out of it. And, you know, when you think about, you just mentioned Big Brother, no one wants the Big Brother government regulating the Internet either. Not no one, but a lot of people are nervous about that. So you have these groups of pretty much, you know, 90-95% of the big websites getting together and coming up with their own guidelines. And then you have the FTC, and this is why this is news right now. Federal Trade Commission has come out with their own 120-page report that was, I think, the end of last week. And they were recommending a number of steps that would include this idea of a Do Not Track button that would appear on various websites. So, you know, I think there is a lot of forward momentum in this, but obviously the devil is in the details. And when you talk about self-regulation, you know, will it work? Who knows? But this is not going away anytime soon.
And actually, looking at an article that I pulled out, our staff pulled out, some of the things the FTC has targeted, as you mentioned, the five privacy measures it wants to see put in place include a universal Do Not Track tool that you could activate to prevent companies from recording your online activities and using them to display personalized advertising. Consumers would only have to opt in once, and companies would be required to comply. Another one
is... Yeah, so you notice you've just used the terms opt-in and opt-out, and that's
right.
The critical thing here. You know, if you have to if you had to opt out, for instance, of receiving ads, you know, you would by default get them, and you could click a button in this case, and you would not get it. It's not clear how this will really be played in. It looks more like you would have to opt in to the idea that you would not get these ads. In other words, if you don't take action, you will be targeted, and you will have this information collected on you. You know, then again, a lot of people are a little less concerned with the idea that they would get ads that might be appropriate, except for the ick factor, as we mentioned. But the broker question is, I think, a bigger one, and it's one that the FTC has definitely looked into, because if you go to these brokers and you were to try to pick up information on me, on anyone, you would find lots of information about what it is that that you've been, where you live, what you buy, and everything else. So that is troubling to a lot of people. So the FTC wants to, among other things, they've suggested setting up a site where you could get this information and pull it all together and see what people have on you, right? So that would be part of it. But there will be a lot of loopholes in terms of, how this works. And, you know, anytime you're expecting the industry to regulate itself, you're going to have some problems. I mean, I'll just give you an example. The Do Not Track, and you had mentioned the Do Not Call list. It's really very different from the Do Not Call list. Do Not Call list is literally a list. And you have to consult the list, see if there's a name on it, and then not call. Then again, we also know that, I don't know about you, but I still get phone calls. And
yeah.
I wonder why. And it's because the loopholes
are... Funny, a lot of them are from politicians.
Exactly. The loopholes are, if it's political or if it's someone you've had a relationship with in terms of done business with them, et cetera, well, there'll be at least as many loopholes here. If you want to collect information, let's say you're a website, and you're collecting information for analytics in order to do research to figure out who's visiting, which is very important for websites, that would be excluded. Anything that you might call, research in general could be excluded. That feels like, an enormous loophole. I think, possibly a necessary one, but how is enforcement going to happen here? It makes for some questions and some serious concerns.
You know, with the FTC now weighing in, clearly, you know, you've got Big Brother government's attention. But with that in mind, and this prospect of government stepping in, I think the old phrase is, if you don't do something about it, government will. Is there any sense of urgency in the industry aggressively pursue, its own policing?
Yes, I think there's a lot of urgency right now, and specifically, they really don't want the government, you know, potentially blundering in and creating a blunt instrument that would make it very difficult for, you know, websites to do the business they need to do. And the other point about these kind of rules, it's very hard to create a set of rules that will that can be applied fairly across the enormous range of websites. And, you know, we've certainly seen when the government has created these kind of rules and laws, they tend to be only partly effective at best. So I think the point here is the industry gets together and they say, okay, guys, let's get our act together here, all right? Let's at least put something. It may be effective, it may be a little bit more of a fig leaf, but let's make it clear that we're trying to address this issue. And, you know, part of the point here is there's do not track, which we've talked about, but there's the idea of do not collect. And most of these laws don't say, you know, that you can't collect, just more like you can't use them. So that becomes a whole other issue. I mean, if there's that information there and it is in some way being collected, and there's some controversy as to whether that would be allowed under various guidelines, it's still enough to certainly creep some people out. Depends what's done with that information, I would think.
Let me interrupt you real quick here, because we've got Troy on the line from here in Columbus.
Okay.
And Troy, you sound like you're a little concerned that data profiles are being leaked to other sources. What's your comment?
Exactly. Kind of what you guys were just getting at. I don't mind the targeted ads. I'll accept the targeted ads. But if they're going to collect these large profiles of data, where will that data end up? You know, you don't want that data end up in the hands of somebody that will use it maliciously, or, you know, that really takes the creep. An advertiser, I don't mind having that data. Some crazy stalker, on the other hand, getting a hold of it is a big deal.
Well, and what we have seen about the both collection of data and how that is retained, I mean, think over the last many years how hard it is to secure large stores of data, right? Think of all of those break-ins. So along with everything else, you may have brokers who have all this information and you don't really know who they are. It feels in some ways, you know, somewhat mysterious. And then, you know, how do we know that information itself is safe? So in many ways, this is something that does need some kind of regulation, whether it's government or you know, industry imposed. You know, this is a real problem.
And we're actually regulated by a little bit of time, so we're going to be coming up on the break, and we'll be coming back with Steve to answer some more questions. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson on 89.7 NPR News.
If you've ever stood in your local Megamart, pulled out your smartphone, and double-checked Amazon against the price in front of you, you know it's true. These days, customers are experts on what things cost, and that's made brick-and-mortar retailers reconsider pricing strategies. I'm Neil Conan, buyers and sellers and the balance of power in retail, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 56 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine this afternoon, warming up to a high of 75. Showers and thunderstorms are likely for tonight, a low of 54 degrees. There's a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms on Wednesday, cloudy skies, a high of 63. Partly cloudy for Wednesday night and a low of 38 degrees. And then some sunshine again for Thursday, a high of 60.
Support for Tech Tuesday comes from Soho Tech, providing computer consulting services to residential and small business customers. More information at 323-4085 or online at sohotechcolumbus.com.
And remember, when you can't be near your radio, you can still listen to our station by streaming on the web. Just visit our website and click on the Listen Now button at the top of the page and stream 89.7 NPR News on your computer or mobile device. Visit WOSU.org. And All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
It's happened again. You sit down and watch the big game like the NCAA championships the other night, or your favorite episode of Mad Men, and you can't find the remote. Where the heck is that thing? Who last saw it? Hey, did the dog get it? That sort of thing. So can your iPhone, however, or iPad Touch come to the rescue? Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, subbing for Ann this week. Joining us now to talk about gadgetry and technology is Geek.com blogger Russell Holly. Russell, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Good. Hey, you were kind of listening in as we were talking to Steve Fox earlier, and I'm kind of interested, you know, I mean, being around technology, especially from the deep end of the, you know, of the technology business here, what's your take on this whole issue of internet tracking and whether there ought to be a do not track list, things like that? Is that even possible? To be done?
I think implementing a do not track list would be incredibly difficult, given that, you know, the internet is a global thing and laws are going to be different in different countries, and websites exist in different countries where they're hosted, and so the rules are very kind of modular based on those environments. So I think implementing something like that on a global scale would be incredibly difficult, if not entirely impossible.
What can people do on their own? I mean, is there existing technology, or are there apps, or are there anything like that that people can use on their own to just say, hey, look, you know what? I really don't want my personal information out here.
The biggest thing that you can look into, you know, there are certainly browsing tools. Google's Chrome, for example, has a tool built into it called Incognito Mode. And Internet Explorer has one very similar as well, where it's a type of browsing experience where none of your information is stored at all. So you can log in, but that information doesn't stay saved. So, you know, let's say you go to your email account and you're used to your email or your Facebook, you know, saving your password for something like that, that incognito mode would do away with that. But it would also make it so that no information that you've entered in gets saved at all on that level.
You see that as probably a more practical way to handle this rather than having the FTC come in and you know, maybe with the big stick?
If it's something that, you know, users feel are concerned, it's something that I think the most appropriate way to handle it is on a user-by-user basis. I have to say, I've experienced several occasions so far where experiencing that moment where I've looked for something on Amazon, I've spent 45 minutes looking for something on Amazon, and I get distracted by something. One of my kids needs my attention or something. I go and find them. And the next day, I've completely forgotten about that thing I was searching for, but it shows up in an ad on another website that I go to because I was searching for it earlier, and it completely brings me back to that shopping experience. And I found that.
Oops. Well, it looks like we've lost Russell briefly here. And we're trying to get him back on the air here. And let me again ask, if you're listening out there and you've got a question about technology, some of the new technology, such as iPads and smartphones, things like that, bad technology. Yeah, bad technology is what happened to his phone. So any rate, but we're trying to get him back. But if you've got a comment or a question that you'd like to put to Russell, please give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I am told Russell is back. Russell, there goes that technology bug. Oh, my God, you know. Makes you want to slap your phone, you know.
Absolutely.
Oh, man. Well, Well, let's kind of get into, you know, speaking of smartphones and things like that. As we talked about at the top of the hour, you know, probably the biggest frustration of sitting at home and watching television these days is when the question comes up, hey, have you seen the remote? conversation that happens in our house a whole lot, especially, oh, yeah, you know, when it gets buried down between the folds of the sofa or something like that. But there is an idea of using iPhones or iPod touches as a universal remote that's been kind of tossed around for a few years. Is it, you think it's finally going to become available to the average consumer?
It's definitely available to the average consumer in a really kind of interesting way, in my opinion. There are two different companies right now that are working that have released these accessories for either your phone or your tablet that allow you to take them and just sit them somewhere in the room, you know, where it's just going to stay in that place and never move. And it actually talks to your local network, your wireless network, and operates with an app on your iPhone or your Android phone or a tablet, and allows you to use your phone to give commands to anything that has an infrared receiver. You know, anything that has that normal remote control receiver. It can be a television, it can be a Blu-ray player, it can be a VCR, if you've got one still set up. And this application is designed to communicate with all of those, you know, very, very fluently.
There are a number of these systems. Some of the options, and maybe, you know, let me throw a couple names at you. The Peel Universal mm-hmm. Control System. What do you hear about that?
Peel is definitely the one that's gotten the most attention, especially for iPhone and iPad users, because it actually has this really interesting shaped thing that they call the fruit. That gets set somewhere, and it's basically it's a little white, you know, kind of pear-shaped thing that has just one side of it is nothing but a big infrared kind of blaster. And you take that and set that somewhere in your room where you've basically pointed that blaster end towards your home entertainment center. And then there's another small piece of technology that you plug into, you know, say a modem or a router in your home, and everything else is done from your iPhone. You know, you go, you load the Peel app, and you can set up as many devices as you want. If you have multiple Peel devices, you can actually set up individual rooms from the app. So you can just open the app and say, okay, I'm in the living room or I'm in the bedroom. And the devices that you've associated with that are all preloaded for you to use.
That is really pretty cool when you think about it. But, you know, I'm kind of hoping maybe they come up with a device that tastes bad for dogs. Because I've actually caught my dog, you know, running around the living room with a remote in his hand like it's a dog toy, which if the TV is on, makes for some really interesting programming changes. Anyway, we've got Robert on the line from Hilliard. Robert, thanks for calling the show. And you've got a question. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about internet security and whatnot. But let's throw this out at Russell and see what he says. Robert, what's your question?
Okay, well, I have, for example, a son-in-law who's on eBay, and he'll leave his browser on all day and just run back and forth and check it throughout the day. Excuse me. At some point in my readings in the last 5-10 years, it seems to me I read that if you're finished with your browser, get off your browser, it's a security breach to just leave it open all day. Any idea on that?
So there was definitely a time where leaving yourself connected to the internet was considered more hazardous to things like security intrusions. But, you know, when you look at the way that a browser functions today, having it open isn't even the more complicated thing, because a lot of, you know, like Internet Explorer, for example, even when you've closed the window, a lot of background processes for Internet Explorer still run. So you haven't actually closed the program per se, and that's due mostly to, you know, the kind of increase in high bandwidth solutions, you know, like Verizon's Fios or Comcast's, you know, high speed internet. It makes it easier to set up something. Maybe you want to download a file or you want to do something. Closing the browser doesn't doesn't stop those processes from happening. And so if your concern is that you would be under some kind of malicious attack by leaving the browser open, it's no different than having your computer connected to the internet these days.
Robert, thank you for the call. Appreciate your calling in on that. Let's kind of go back again to the use of the iPhones and iPads. I'm curious, and again, having worked, and you wouldn't know this, but some people out there listening might. I worked in television news for about 22 years, and I'm curious as to what kind of an impact the idea of being able to use an iPhone or iPod Touch might have on the industry, television, cable, because it seems to me that would give the consumer even more opportunities to just flip around the dial like a madman.
That's certainly a possibility. I mean, one of the biggest features, in my opinion, to Peel, and it's the other application that does something very similar, which is called Digit, is that isn't so much that it can control these devices, because, the ability to control a TV using a third-party kind of electronic device has been around for a while. I had that on my first Palm Pilot. But what makes this truly unique, in my opinion, is that it uses your internet connection and it uses the knowledge that has been shared by your cable company to give you complete access to your TV guide from that same application. So I think that you're entirely right in that the ability to flip around would be increased, because without having to adjust what's going on my television at all, I can flip around and see what's going on these different channels. I can see, what shows are being done. And I can look at the schedule for the next, 14 or 16 hours. I can plan, what I'm going to watch next for a long time out. And all I have to do is tap, that TV show, and the smartphone sends the command to change the channel, to 245 or what have you. And it happens, with a single push of a button. I don't have to press 245 or, set up a specific time to watch. It does all of it automatically. And so I think that you're incredibly right that it would cause, a much faster, change in what it is that you're watching, switching back and forth between things.
I can envision a lot of television programmers and advertising executives reaching for an Excedrin bottle right now, because certainly that's been an issue. How do you get people's attention span and hold it? And not just from an advertising standpoint, but from an informational standpoint. If you're doing a network newscast or a local newscast, you better be able to grab people's attention right away and then hold it, because it's going to become that much more easy for them to just say, yeah, I'm bored. And, I keep envisioning somebody doing the clapper. Clap on, clap off, but essentially it's almost, it seems to be almost the same principle.
Absolutely.
Another piece is that there are also smart TVs out there from, I'm told, from Samsung, Philips, Toshiba, and Panasonic that when you buy them and install them, you can actually download a free app from iTunes that'll essentially do the same thing and work as a remote control.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of these cases. We've talked about some of the smart TVs in the past here on the show, especially the Apple TV and Google TV, how they can just be plugged into regular TVs as well as these smart TVs that have come out. And that is very true. One of the things you can do, you can go to the App Store, you can go to, the Android market, and these controls, they don't give you some of the same functionality that the Peel remote does with access to, like, the TV guide and things like that. But it makes it so that you can just pull your phone out anytime you want to change the channel. And an interesting kind of side thing that I've found is, if I'm in the office doing something and one of my kids is in the other room and they've turned the volume up on the TV too loud, I don't have to be in the room because it's all connected to the internet. I can just open up the app on my phone and turn the volume down from my chair. It's an interesting, way to look at technology.
You just made me think of my own daughters, will you turn that thing down? Oh my goodness! I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what. If that's out there and possible, I can really mess with their heads when they're watching something else. Turn the volume down to the point of zero. That ought to be interesting. Let's talk a little bit about some new features that have come to Google and Hangouts, and including the ability to make phone calls from Hangouts. And let's back up a little bit. Why don't you explain to our listeners what is the Google Plus Hangout?
So very much like Facebook and Twitter and Path and a lot of these other social networks, Google has their own social network that's called Google Plus. And we've talked about it a couple of times on the show before. One of my favorite features to Google Plus is this Hangout service. It's been used by a lot of different people to connect multiple groups. You know, you can have up to 9 people, including yourself, so you can have 10 people in a video chat room for free. You know, you can share documents and you can just really do a lot of really positive communication things, like sharing documents and things like that. And they've rolled out a lot of really impressive updates over the last week or so, the first of which being, like you said, the ability to make phone calls from the Hangout. You know, we talked about Google Voice last week and the ability to make calls from your computer and from your phone using a separate phone number from the one that you've been given. And Google's actually taken that same service and integrated it into Hangouts in such a way that you can have, let's say 5 or 6 people in a room. Maybe you've got, a business meeting where you've got a bunch of people, but Tim is out and about. He's not in the meeting space. But you can actually use Hangouts to call him, and you can set the call up in a way that he can hear everyone that's in the Hangout, and everyone that's in the Hangout can hear and speak to him. And it just adds it as though it's another person in the Hangout, and it's just a phone call. It works just as well as any other phone call.
And everybody can just hang out.
Yeah. I mean, you can. I found it to be really useful for short meetings, or there are people that I talk to that are in other countries. One of the really interesting things about Google Voice is that their international rates are actually really low. Calling domestically is free with Google Voice, and the international rates are really inexpensive compared to a lot of different phone companies. So it's been an interesting way to communicate with a lot of different people, in my opinion.
That is an interesting business application, because that is something that, if you do business internationally, that is a big concern, is the cost of those communications. We're coming up on a break fairly soon here, but stay with us. Russell's going to be back. And if you've got a comment or a question for Russell, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us on allsides@wosu.org, and we'll be back shortly.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Peter Beinart talks about his new book, The Crisis of Zionism. He supports Israel, but thinks the Jewish settlements in the West Bank are compromising Israel's commitment to democracy. He's proposed a boycott of goods made in those Jewish settlements. We'll get a response from Gary Rosenblatt, editor and publisher of the Jewish Week of New York. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. You can support WOSU Public Media by becoming a volunteer. We are looking for volunteers to take calls of support from listeners during our upcoming 89.7 NPR News Spring Membership Drive. If you are interested in becoming a volunteer, visit WOSU.org/volunteers or call 614-292-9678.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, offering perspective in a time of economic uncertainty to help grow and maintain wealth. Details at themontgomerysolution.com.
Mostly sunny skies today, along with some clouds, a high of 75 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms for tonight, a low of 54. There's still a slight chance of rain for Wednesday and a high of 63. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I love that little piano riff for the theme music. It's really pretty cool. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, subbing for Ann for a few days this week. And joining us again to talk about gadgetry and technology is GeekTalk.com blogger Russell Holley. Russell, thanks for being with us this morning. It's been really interesting to talk to you about some of these new devices, and it truly You had made reference to being on the show last week, and it truly strikes me that this is a world we're living in where we're literally, you know, that's so last week in terms of technology. it just amazes me. I think back to the technology that I grew up with or that my parents had, and somebody made the comment to me the other day, that a much younger person than I am, do you mean phones once had dials?
I can absolutely understand that. I actually had an interesting experience yesterday when I got the press announcement that that GameStop, a video game retailer, actually decided that they were no longer going to accept trade-ins on the Nintendo GameCube because the device had been considered a legacy device.
Yeah.
That really just didn't even come out all that long ago. So it was kind of a rush to see that and go, okay, so that we really are moving that fast. It's interesting.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. It strikes me that things change so fast on the technology side right now that you almost wonder if the market for recycling these things must come and go almost every bit as fast.
Oh, absolutely. There are some interesting research that's been done into third party, particularly with smartphones, because it kind of feels like there's a new smartphone coming out every week. It's actually one of the things, in my opinion, that's to Apple's credit that they only release an iPhone once a year. But it feels like there's a new smartphone coming out every week, and it's become such a thing that there are actual websites that take phones and resell them in a third party way. It's kind of like an eBay, but just for smartphones.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
And it's funny you should mention that because in my notes here, I'm seeing that the Nokia Lumina 900 is being released this week on Friday. So, maybe tell us a little bit about that one and not only why it's different, but how long it's going to last before the Nokia Lumina 1000 comes out.
So this is actually an interesting thing to look at, in my opinion, because this is, Nokia and Microsoft have paired together. These are two companies that were really affected, in my opinion, by, the rush of, the popularity behind the iPhone and these Android phones that have come out. Microsoft, the Windows phone was the phone of businesses. It was either BlackBerry or Windows phone for a long time now, and that kind of went away. And Nokia, has been in the cell phone business for as long as I can remember. They've always had, some kind of cell phone out there. In my mind, they were, ubiquitous with being a phone that you could run over with a car and not have it, ever have any problems with it. And so it's interesting to see these two companies come together, after being, almost pushed out of the cell phone industry by, Apple and Google. To come back together to release a device like the Lumia 900. It's got a lot of interesting features to it. It's a little bit bigger than the iPhone in terms of screen size. It's a 4.3-inch screen instead of a 3.5-inch screen. And it actually comes with Nokia's got some really interesting technology in their glass that makes it so that in broad daylight, the sun doesn't completely wash out the screen and make it unusable.
That's got to be the biggest complaint I have about the electronic devices that I use. I've got a Samsung smartphone, and you get out on a bright day like it's been here the last several days, and you gotta try and bend over and create your own shade just to look,
absolutely.
And that is a complete pain in the, at any rate, that's good to hear, because when you see a manufacturer come out with something like that, it won't be long before their competitors, take note and everybody starts to offer that,
absolutely.
That'll be
good. Apparently they use some kind of, it's similar. Apparently the technology works very similar to how, polarizing lenses work in sunglasses. So that the screen, just is able to produce the same amount of color without without doing anything. And all the pictures that I've seen of the phone so far, the screen, the glass when it's not on, looks really, really dark, kind of like polarized sunglasses. So it'd be interesting to see.
I bet you there's a lot of our listeners that were out there who are wearing sunglasses on a bright day like today saying, why didn't I think of that? I could have made millions on this.
Oh, so, absolutely.
Yeah, anyway, and speaking of our listeners, if you're out there listening and you've got a question for Russell, you know, he I am told, is the answer man when it comes to technology. So 614-292-8513 is our phone number for you to call in with your comment or your question. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can look us up on Facebook or Twitter and get your comment or question in that way as well. So we're really pleased to have Russell with us, because we're kind of running down the list of different technology that's coming up. But let me jump ahead in my notes a little bit, because this was a topic of conversation actually in our editorial meeting about the show the other day. Consumer Reports is jumping all over the new iPad, saying that, you know, it really literally is, it isn't just a hot item, it's literally hot, you know, that the new iPad reached temperatures of 116 degrees Fahrenheit after 45 minutes of running an intense action game, and that's 13 degrees hotter, I'm told, than the iPad 2. You know, is that kind of heat generation, should that be a concern for people who buy it? What's your take on that?
It's interesting to keep in mind, and this is something that kind of bothered me about the way Consumer Reports approach this situation, is that this is not something that's new. Anyone that's owned a laptop in the last, I'm going to go ahead and say 10 years, knows that if you have a thing, you know, that has, you know, that generates heat, especially, you know, a computer, you take and you run it as intensely as possible. Let's say, you know, you're watching movies or playing video games or something, it gets hot. The iPad 2 and the original iPad, because they were they weren't devices that had things like fans, and they were running, you know, relatively smaller processors, and the batteries weren't particularly big. These were things that we just never really noticed. The iPad, the new iPad is a lot more powerful. You know, it's got the screen requires a lot more energy, and it outputs a lot more energy. It's got a much bigger battery that's going to warm up when it's being used, and the processor in it has, you know, the graphics capabilities are much higher than it's been seen in mobile devices so far. So it's going to get a little bit warmer. And if you do something like watch a movie, it's not going to heat up. It's not, you know, you're not going to see that kind of problem. There are really graphically intense games on the iPad that if you can sit and play for, you know, for an hour, then yes, you'll notice that it does get, you know, about 10 to 15 degrees warmer. But it's not, you know, the cool thing about the design behind the iPad, and Apple's done this with a lot of their technology, is the whole back of the device is this special kind of aluminum that is intentionally designed to disperse heat. So if you've got the iPad, you know, sitting in your lap or sitting on a blanket or something like that, where it's just going to sit and get warmer, then it will continue to get warmer. But the way that the tablet is designed, you're not really setting it on a blanket or setting it in your lap. You're holding it in your hand. And so it's going to continue to disperse that heat across the aluminum backplate, and it's going to cool off just as quickly as it heated up.
It's interesting. I just had a vision of my mother come into my head of, you know, saying, "Oh dear, it's a little hot. I think I'll give it a cold bath." You know, so she once did that to my dad on the interstate one day. We our car overheated, and she took a bottle of ice cold water and poured it into the radiator, and you could hear the engine crack. So, yeah, and I mean, she's my mother's wonderful. I love her to death, but you know, but she's, you know, not mechanically or technologically inclined. So, going back to the new iPad. One of the other criticisms that Consumer Reports noted was that it doesn't charge when you're running these intensive programs, mostly gaming, even when it's plugged in. Is this any different from the predecessor, the iPad 2?
You're running into a similar issue here from the heating, in that it's generating a lot more power. And it's not so much that it's not charging. It's just that it's using the same amount of energy using the same amount of power that it's consuming. So if you plug it in and you start playing one of these really intensive games and your battery is at, you know, 35%, it will stay at 35%. It's not going to continue to go down. It'll just stay at 35% while you're playing that game, because it's using the same amount of power that it's getting from the machine.
So, you know, it really shouldn't be a concern. You know, whatever you had in there when you started, it'll be what you had when you finish.
Correct.
Yeah. The heat concerns don't seem to be holding the new iPad back because it still tops Consumer Reports' list of best buys. Can we attribute that high rating to those really sharp screen images and the retinal display, that sort of thing?
The retina display is an interesting concept. I mean, the retina display really kind of changed how we look at things on the iPhone and how things go. But when you take that same technology and you blow it up to something as big as the iPad screen, that kind of 10-inch screen, you change a couple of things, and it ends up causing just as many problems as it does solving. If you're looking at things like pictures that you found online, or if you're trying to read a book that you've downloaded, that retina display is really incredible because it does, it does take a load off the eyes and it allows for the colors and images to really pop. When you start to do productive things on the new iPad with the retina display, especially when you're doing things like browsing websites, things start to get a little strange because, the retina display has, more pixels in theory, has a higher resolution than, most people's high definition televisions and certainly more than most computers. Well, web browsers, particularly websites are built for those computer screens and those, those kind of high definition ranges of visual experience. So websites start to look kind of funky on the new iPad. The images don't show up correctly, or you end up having things in really compressed spaces and you have to zoom around to see what it is you want, because none of these sites have been able to optimize their website for the iPad, and the cost of doing so in terms of how large your website becomes at that point is really significant. The downside to having such a massive resolution is that in order to place images on a screen of that resolution, they have to be much bigger in size, which means that their storage they have to take up much more storage. So a website that would normally take, let's say 4 megabytes to load on, let's say the iPhone, now takes, nearly 5 times that to load on the iPad. And that's going to cause your internet connection, you're demanding more from your internet connection to load the exact same web page.
Almost sounds like Apple's trying to drive the market as far as web design.
Well, they've certainly done that in the past, and that's not a bad thing. It would be really impressive to see this kind of screen get rolled out to, proper computers, to see this kind of the retina display technology be implemented on, let's say, the MacBook Air or the MacBook, line of computers or even Windows computers. That would be a really impressive thing to see, and it would certainly cause the web as a whole to kind of move to these larger formats and be able to solve some of these kind of storage problems. But it's because this is really the only device of its kind right now in terms of browsing the web, the web designers of the world are left with two options. They can either, accept the fact that iPhone users or iPad users are going to have kind of an awkward experience on their website, or they can spend a lot of time and resources trying to optimize for a device that it only ends up being that one device that they're optimizing for.
And we've got a few minutes left in the show, a little more than 5 minutes maybe. And again, I'd like to ask our listeners, if you've got a question for Russell, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we actually had an email from John, and a little bit off topic, but it's worth asking. He's asking you, what are your recommendations for routers?
Interesting question as far as routers go. There's a couple of different companies that are out there that make a lot of really good ones. In my opinion, Buffalo isn't one that you see as often in stores, but their durability is something that I've come to really appreciate. Most of the time you can find those on either Amazon or places like that for routers. My personal favorite for in-house is actually the Apple AirPort. It's actually one of the few Apple devices that I own in the house and I use more than just about anything, because it's very plug and play. You plug things in and you turn them on. It doesn't matter if you have Apple devices in the home or you have Windows devices in the home. And its troubleshooting is incredibly simple. There's a program that gets installed on your computer, and it has a green light if things are working, and an orange light if things need to be looked at, and a red light if things are not working. And, you know, the troubleshooting steps that go along with that are really good. So it's a little more expensive. The Apple AirPort routers are, I think they run right around, $130, depending on which model you're looking for, because some of them can also have hard drives built in for network-based backup stuff, which is pretty exciting, but really kind of technical. My personal opinion would be to choose between either an Apple AirPort or a Buffalo router.
And we've got a caller on the line. Mark is calling in with a question. He's asking, is the iPad really better than other tablets? But Mark, Mark's from Marysville, and let's have you ask that question yourself.
Yeah, and I'm sorry if this issue was addressed previously in another show, but I'm just curious if the iPad is really worth it. We talked about getting the tablet, not sure if we want to spend the extra money, or is there another manufacturer out there that's created something that's just as useful?
In my opinion, the screen on the iPad is really nice, but the hardware is pretty similar to the previous iPad. You're going to be able to play better games on it, but if gaming is what you're looking for, you know, on a device, then tablet's not really kind of what you're looking for. It really kind of depends on what kind of device you want. You know, my personal opinion, I don't like 10-inch tablets. I think that the 7-inch or the 8-inch size tablets are much better because they're much more portable. I can slide them in my back pocket if I need to, or I can toss them in a book bag. And you don't get that kind of portability from the iPad, in my opinion. If you're really concerned about screen resolution, then I would say go for an iPad. But really, you know, in terms of just sheer computing power and the ability to, you know, remain relevant for longer than, you know, let's say the next 6 months or a year, there are a lot of different other companies out there doing some really exciting things. For example, Asus, the Transformer Prime Infinity, if you can, you know, escape that impossibly long name, actually has a keyboard dock that you can place the tablet in, and it gives you almost like a laptop experience when you want it. And that keyboard also has a much bigger battery in it. So what you normally get out of a device that has about 10 hours now gets you closer to 15 or 20 hours of constant use. And you can use it very much like you would use a computer, and you can just take the screen off when you just want that tablet experience.
Mark, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate your checking in with us this week on Tech Tuesday. And Russell, real quick, because we're coming up on the end of the show, but real quick, I was going to ask, what's the next big thing coming in the coming year? But what's the next best thing coming in the next day or so?
Well, I mean, really, in the next day or so, there's a lot of, especially when you're looking at smartphones, HTC and Sprint are supposed to be announcing some pretty exciting stuff tomorrow, for what's going to happen for Sprint users. So if you're a Sprint user and not interested in the iPhone, there's going to be what they're going to call the HTC Evo 1, which is a really impressive phone. It's actually one of the first phones that I've seen where the casing is ceramic. Instead of like an aluminum or a plastic, and as such, gives it a really kind of durable feel to it.
That's pretty cool. I think that that's going to be interesting to watch. Well, this has been a really interesting hour talking about technology with our guests earlier, Steve Fox from PC World Magazine, and currently Russell Holley, who is the tech blogger at Geek.com. Russell, thank you very much for joining us. I'm kind of hosting this show as a substitute this week, but this is the fourth show in a row where I've learned something new, and I'm hoping our listeners have as well. Russell Holley, from tech blogger from Geek.com, and I'm assuming that people can contact you through Geek.com too.
Yes, you can.
Okay, great. Russell, thanks again. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7. NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from Thurber House, presenting author Beth Gutchen reading from her latest novel, Gossip, a story of intimacy and betrayal, Wednesday, April 4th at the Columbus Museum of Art. Tickets at thurberhouse.org.